Today's episode is brought to you by Canby Foursquare Church. Since 1978, a place to grow, connect, and serve. In-person services are back with some restrictions to help ensure everyone stays safe and healthy. For the latest, visit their website at canbyfoursquare.com.
Welcome to Now Hear This, Canby,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Welcome to the Now Hear This, Canby podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Martina Baker, and this is what's happening this week in our community. Former House Minority Leader and Canby State Representative Christine Drazen on Tuesday secured the Republican nod in the 2022 Oregon governor's race, winning nearly a quarter of the vote. In the extremely crowded Republican primary, Drazen came in 5 points ahead of second-place contender Bob Tiernan, a former state House representative for Lake Oswego and chair of the Oregon GOP from 2009 to 2011. As of 6:30 on Wednesday, she had captured more than 65,000 of the 275,000 votes cast, or 23.5%, to Tiernan's 18.4% share, and the Associated Press called the race in her favor. Tiernan had called Drazen earlier in the day to concede. Sandy Mayor Stan Pulliam was in third place with 10% of the vote, a respectable showing for a small-town mayor who had not previously held or sought higher office, but has worked hard for over a year to build grassroots support across the state in a series of town halls and a strong social media presence. Longtime House Speaker Tina Kotek captures a Democratic bid to replace Kate Brown, who is term-limited, taking 56% of the vote and fending off a challenge from State Treasurer Tobias Reed. Drazen, who served 1.5 terms as state representative for Canby's district, formally announced her candidacy in January and quickly established herself as one of the front runners in the crowded Republican primary race with nearly 20 other hopefuls. She received the largest amount of Republican donor support of any candidate and reported spending $2.7 million as of election night. Drazen becomes the first female Republican gubernatorial nominee since Norma Palouse in 1986, setting the stage for an all-woman race for governor, the first in Oregon history, with Kotek and Bensie Johnson, a former Democratic lawmaker who is running a well-funded bid as an independent. In House District 51, which includes Canby, incumbent James Heeb is holding a strong lead over primary challenger Lisa Davidson, with 60% to 39% as of Wednesday night. Democrat Walt Trandum was unopposed in his HD 51 primary. In Senate District 26, which also includes Canby under the new legislative boundaries, current State Representative Daniel Bonham of the Dalles was far ahead of his two primary challengers, Steve Bates and Michael Nugent. Democrat Roz Mason, also of the Dalles, was unopposed. In Congress, Oregon's 5th District showed Democratic challenger Jamie McLeod Skinner holding a stout lead over longtime Representative Kurt Schrader of Canby. McLeod Skinner, an attorney and consultant who positioned herself to the left of the more moderate Schrader, had a 7,000-vote lead, capturing 60% to his 40%. However, with an estimated 95% of Democratic results still uncounted in Schrader's base of Clackamas County, representing at least 30,000 to 40,000 ballots, the race remains too early to call. Of the approximately 1,600 Democratic votes reported so far in Clackamas, Schrader had won 57% of them. Indeed, Schrader appeared to have won three of the four counties in Oregon's fifth, while badly losing Deschutes, where McLeod Skinner claimed 71% of the vote. In the Republican race for Oregon's fifth, former Happy Valley Mayor Lori Chavez de Remer was in the lead with 41% of the vote, followed by Jimmy Crumpacker at 32%. Shortly after 11 p.m., her campaign declared victory. In commission races, incumbent Paul Savas was leading in the effort to keep his seat amid a cadre of challengers, including Libra Ford, Steve Frost, and Bill Osborne, while incumbent Sonia Fisher was trailing conservative Wilsonville City Councilor Ben West. But given the large numbers of ballots that remained uncounted in Clackamas County, particularly for Democratic-leaning voters, both races were too early to call. Secretary of State Shamia Fagan on Tuesday night blasted Clackamas County for its significant delays in reporting the results on election night, while expressing confidence that the results, when they eventually arrive, can be trusted. As Oregon's chief election officer and a Clackamas County voter, I'm deeply concerned about the delay in reporting from Clackamas County elections tonight, she said in a statement shortly before 11 p.m. While I am confident that the process they are following is secure, transparent, and the results will be accurate, the county's reporting delays tonight are unacceptable. Voters have done their jobs, and now it's time for Clackamas County elections to do theirs. Clackamas County Clerk Sherry Hall reported earlier this month that a misprinted barcode had been discovered that would cause problems and significant delays in reporting the results. Officials later estimated the error affecting the printing of up to two-thirds of the ballots that have been sent to voters, with the mistake appearing to disproportionately affect registered Democrats. Hall told the Clackamas County Board of Commissioners last week that her office had used a certified print shop that had served the county for more than a decade without any serious problems. The normal process would be that the initial results are everything that has come in as of Monday, the day before, Hall told commissioners on Thursday. I'm not sure how close we're going to get to that because of what's happened, but we plan to have our tallies by 8:15. We will know how many are left. And yet, little was normal on election night in Clackamas County. The first results were not posted on the county's website until 8:45, though the report itself said it had run at 7:14 and were not reported to the state until after 9:30. And those results were woefully incomplete. More than 65,000 ballots had been returned as of Monday, a turnout of 21.4%. But in the results Tuesday night, only about 10,000 were tabulated, including fewer than 7,000 Republican ballots and fewer than 2,000 Democratic ones. That left approximately 85,000 ballots still to be tallied in Clackamas County, accounting for an estimated 80% of the Republican primary vote and 96% of the Democratic one. And while several statewide races were decisive enough to call on election night without the vote totals from Clackamas, many local and regional ones remained in doubt. Fagan appeared to have little sympathy, saying the clerk knew about the printing issue weeks before Election Day and should have had ample time to address the situation. County Administrator Gary Schmidt told commissioners last week that he had pulled 37 workers and volunteers, including himself, to assist the election office. Fagan said she had also offered extra personnel. We eagerly await a response from county election officials on how we can aid in the timely processing of results, Fagan said. I am disappointed that we have not seen more urgency from election officials in Clackamas County. a pedestrian died after being struck by a passenger train shortly before noon on Sunday near the railroad crossing at North Ivy Street in downtown Canby. Emergency officials have confirmed. The victim was Ocean MacArthur, a 23-year-old man who lived in Canby with his grandmother, Julie Whitney. MacArthur was northbound on Ivy and headed to Cusford's Market for groceries, Whitney said in a Facebook post that she shared with the community. She said he was wearing earbuds and listening to his music, as was his habit. At the time, the railroad crossing arms were down and lights flashing due to a Union Pacific freight train that was stopped at Ivy Street to change and unload its cars. Witnesses said MacArthur was climbing between the cars of the stopped UP train when he jumped onto the spur track and into the path of a southbound Amtrak train, whose engineer did not see him. Officers who were having lunch at a nearby restaurant were quick to the scene, where they found and interviewed several eyewitnesses. Emergency medical crews from Canby Fire arrived and confirmed the victim was deceased. Fire personnel assisted officers with notifications to the family, according to Canby Fire Chief Jim Davis. "We feel tremendously sorry for the family of the victim," said Davis, who was on the scene. "Our thoughts and prayers are with them." Though some have blamed the incident on the city's controversial Quiet Zone project, which would make it so train engineers are no longer required to blow their horns at Canby's three downtown intersections, including Ivy, Now Hear This Canby has confirmed the Quiet Zone is not yet in effect. Some required striping remains to be done before railroad officials will sign off on the zone designation. Once the Quiet Zone is in effect, engineers still could and would blow their horns in an emergency situation. Officials urge residents to use caution when crossing the railroad tracks, obey all signs and signals, and never climb on, between, or under stop train cars. Sadly, Canby has a long history of pedestrians and motorists who have lost their lives on the tracks, sometimes intentionally. In February of 2018, a 17-year-old Canby High School student was hit by a UP freight train at the same intersection in what was believed to be an act of suicide. In March of 2016, two died after being hit by a northbound Amtrak passenger train near South End Road, north of Canby, also likely suicides, according to the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office. In 2012, Canby resident Robert Baker, 46, was struck by an Amtrak train while walking along the tracks near Cedar Street, an apparent accident. The area was not marked for pedestrian or vehicle crossings. And two men were killed in August of 2008 with a Clackamas County Fair in full swing nearby when their car got stuck on the tracks and was hit by another Amtrak train, this one bound for Eugene. A rainy late spring is delaying the start of fire season in Oregon, but state officials said on Monday they still anticipate a challenging summer and fall. Large fires are already blazing in New Mexico, and fire risk in the Northwest is expected to worsen as summer continues. During a press conference on Monday, Governor Kate Brown and officials from several Oregon agencies that deal with wildfires said they're preparing for an intense fire season. "We know from the past several years that we're fighting fires of a new age, made more intense by the impacts of climate change," Brown said. "Almost every fire season since I became governor has been more complex and more difficult, from Chetco Bar in 2017 to the Labor Day fires of 2020 and last year's Bootleg fire." The Chetco Bar fire in southwest Oregon burned nearly 200,000 acres. Five simultaneous fires that ignited around Labor Day in 2020 burned more than 1 million acres and destroyed more than 4,000 homes west of the Cascades. The Bootleg fire, the third largest in state history, burned more than 400,000 acres in southern Oregon last summer. Despite late spring storms that boosted the Cascade snowpack and poured rain on Portland and the Willamette Valley, most of the state remains in drought. Brown has declared drought emergencies in 15 counties so far this year. "All signs point to a difficult 2022 fire season that will challenge our firefighting teams and the capacity of our response systems," Brown said. The good news is that Oregon has one of the best wildfire response systems in the country. In May of 2021, National Drought Monitors at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln classified all of Oregon as abnormally dry or in various stages of drought. Northwest Oregon has managed to avoid dry or drought conditions so far this year, but most of the land east of the Cascades is classified as exceptional or extreme drought, the two highest conditions. By the time drought reaches that level, wells can start running dry, lakes or reservoirs are very low, fish and rivers are affected by high water temperatures, and wildfires are harder to manage. Campers should check local restrictions before starting campfires and make sure they're fully extinguished before leaving the campsite. If a former campfire isn't cool to the touch, it has not been fully extinguished. Oregonians should also avoid driving or parking over dry grass and make sure their vehicles aren't trailing chains, mufflers, or other parts that could spark a flame. People should also follow local rules for fireworks or burning debris and avoid both in dry areas or on windy days. Brown asked all Oregonians to do their part in preventing and preparing for wildfires. Being prepared can truly mean the difference between life and death, Brown said. It is also one of the best ways you can help our frontline firefighters do their jobs. Make a plan with your family, stay informed, and get 2 weeks ready. And please be smart and be careful when you're enjoying your outdoors. You can help prevent tragic loss. Cougar Country, hometown sports coverage, is brought to you by Rife and Hunsaker PC. When you need an attorney, turn to the firm that Canby has trusted for over 50 years. Call them today at 503-266-3456. For the latest sports news, follow us on Twitter at Cougar Country OR and Instagram at Cougar Country POD. After dropping the first two games of the week against Lake Oswego, the Canby Cougar baseball team got its revenge in the third and final game of the Three Rivers League series. The Cougars, fresh off of a sweep of the Tualatin Timberwolves, came into the week hot, but they were facing a team that was even hotter in Lake Oswego, which had won seven straight after starting the season 3-10, and they kept that momentum going in game one. The Lakers scored all of their runs in the first inning, putting two quick ones on the board thanks to a triple by Grant Maxwell. After giving up two runs and two hits in the opening inning, Cougar pitcher Joe Bruckmiller righted the ship by throwing a scoreless remainder of the game and striking out five. After three hits in the first five innings, Canby's bats exploded in the top of the fifth with three singles, including an RBI from Clayton Langdale that loaded the bases and gave the Cougars a run. Despite the prime position, Langdale's last gasp wasn't enough. A double play quickly ended the inning and all but ensured the 2-1 loss. Though Canby jumped out to a quick 1-0 lead the next day, the Lakers soon took control in what would become a runaway 13-3 win. Lake Oswego tallied, added to their win streak with 13 runs off of 13 hits and 13 RBIs, including four runs in the fifth inning to break open the game. Although the Cougars totaled 9 hits in the game, they were unable to finish things off, leaving runners stranded. The Cougars headed home with two losses and risking suffering their first sweep of the season. But just 2 days after their second loss, the team finally put it all together before the home crowd. The Cougs blasted out of the gates with a 4-run first inning and weathered the storm to snap Lake Oswego's 9-game winning streak. Canby's first inning success was in a large part thanks to Kellen Oakes. The senior drove in two runs with a double and scored another courtesy of Logan Robinson to help be a part of three of Canby's four runs. The other was thanks to a Langdale RBI grounder. While Canby's lead ballooned to four when Theo Netter sent Evans home in the third, Lake Oswego was not eager to have their win streak stopped. The Lakers inched within one run, cutting the deficit to 5-4, before Oakes slammed the door shut on the mound with a strikeout. A single by Mikey Gibson gave the Cougs a safety net, and Oakes closed out the game to win 6-4.
Hey, Tyler, read any good books lately? Yeah, actually, I'm reading a really good one right now.
Awesome. What's it about?
It's kind of complicated, but there's like these two kids with an absent parent, and then this mysterious stranger shows up with his sinister accomplices, and they just start wreaking havoc in their lives. I think it's like a Faustian metaphor.
Wow, that sounds really dense.
It is.
Interesting, though. Who wrote it?
You know, I think it's like a doctor, starts with like an S or something. Sass, sos.
Tyler, are you reading The Cat in the Hat?
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to. It's taken me like 2 months to get this far.
Okay. Well, hey, whatever your interest or reading level, open the world of all things books at the Book Nook in downtown Canby.
Yeah, guys, this local independently owned and operated store is your one-stop shop for the latest releases and great deals on a huge variety of previously owned books, as well as games, art, and writing supplies and gifts.
They also do book clubs and game nights if you're looking for some fun, healthy activities right here in Canby. And hey, you know, for you, Tyler, they have a really expansive selection of children's books.
Oh, cool. Anyway, check them out on Facebook and Instagram, online at booknookcanby.com, or stop by 294 Northwest 2nd Avenue and let their friendly staff introduce you to your new favorite read. Hey, Frankie, why do you think I'd be interested in children's books?
We'll talk about it later.
Oh, okay.
This is Roz Mason, and I'm running for State Senate District 26, which now includes Canby. I know we need affordable housing, a strong local economy, and to face climate challenges of wildfire and heat waves like last year's that hit 118 in the Dalles, where I live. Climate courage also includes upsides, like becoming more energy independent using renewables and helping our district get in on innovative technology and manufacturing jobs. I'm visiting Canby and Sandy April 14th through 16th. I'd love to see you. Visit masonfororegon.com for info and to get a yard sign. Paid for by Mason for Oregon.
Tootie Smith, Chair of the Clackamas County Board of Commissioners, and I'm here today to discuss the release of election results for the May 17 primary. First of all, I want to thank the news media for being very vigilant in reporting this situation and getting the word out. First of all, there is a bright side to this situation. It is that we have had a significant voter turnout on election day, with over 31 trays of ballots that were delivered to the county elections office to be counted this morning. That tells me the voters have faith in our process and the assurances given that their voices will be handled securely and carefully. The most critical outcome right now is honoring those who have voted to get the final verified numbers as quickly and securely as possible. We, as a county commission, are expecting the election department to be accountable to every voter in Clackamas County. We will assist them by supplying additional people and any other resource necessary to ensure a timely, accurate election process and honoring voter integrity. The fact that they were behind in issuing results is no surprise. They have known about the blurred barcodes for weeks. They must take the steps necessary to correct this problem they knew about weeks ago. Hand processing of the ballots is slow and tedious work that has to be done accurately, and in this case, briskly. They need much more capacity to do that, and Oregon law dictates the process that must be used in this case. While the county clerk is an independently elected official, the county commission can provide resources. Our county administrator is redeploying over 200 county employees to assist in this process. Those employees will work two shifts starting tomorrow, 7 to 6 every day until the vote is completed. Facility space at elections is being expanded to accommodate the increased staff. I have been and I will continue to be on site regularly to observe the process, as any member of the public is allowed to do so, and I invite anybody down to view the process. Even with the limited authority over the elections process, you can expect vigilance on the part of the county commission. This is an all hands on deck moment. Here at Clackamas County, we are people who know how to pull our boots on and get the job done for our residents. Nothing less is expected from our own county clerk, Sherry Hall, who said she is committed to providing updated results daily until all votes are counted. Thank you, and I will entertain any questions at this time. Lisa.
Chairwoman, you mentioned this has been known about for weeks. Why wasn't adequate staffing figured out and put into place ahead of time?
My county administrator offered additional staff immediately and any resource. Sherry Hall did not take us up on that offer immediately, and I think you would have to ask her why they didn't do it immediately.
But clearly that was a big mistake, a second mistake.
I believe it was a mistake not to make assurances, because it was predicted that a 30% voter turnout, right? And in Clackamas County's case, there were 307,000 ballots mailed. That's about 90,000 ballots that they knew that they had to remedy to make good in order to run through the voting machine. I have insisted with her, as my other commissioners and county staff has, that she needs to correct the problem and move forward.
Talk about these 200, Eric Mock, K2 News. Talk about these 200 employees that are going to be deployed in these two shifts every day. Now, are they going to be helping duplicate the ballots, count the ballots? What exactly are they going to be doing?
Well, you know, this is the hand processing of the ballots is somewhat confusing. What those county employees will be doing is duplicating the ballots onto a clean ballot. One person will be reading it, the other will be marking the ballot, and then they switch and double check each other. They're also from two separate political parties that does this. And when that process is done, the duplicated ballots will be put through the voting machine, because the clerk is not hand counting them, they are hand duplicating them, and that is provided for in Oregon law.
Is 200 employees enough
to
get this done, Tommy Mann?
We have offered 1,000 employees. If it takes 1,000 employees, then we'll send over 1,000 people to do this. Our employees, I'm so happy. We had 200 volunteer that fast this morning. If we need more, we will do more. And I will say the work is hard and tedious, and you can do it about 6 hours, and your vision is tired, and you're just worn out from that. So the people are not allowed to work back-to-back shifts because they need to take a break. Also, not every person will come day after day after day. So we have processes in place to bring on more county employees as necessary. I have to say, at Clackamas County, this is a priority. It's all hands on deck. And other jobs will just be on pause until this work is done.
Chair Smith, Tim Gordon. You said you'd offered 1,000. If you were county clerk, how many would you want to have working tomorrow, today?
Well, I would have whatever capacity my building allowed, and I would expand capacity at another building, and we do have other buildings available. But the problem is, by law, we have to allow for a secure place, some security cameras, and we have to allow viewing for the public to see what is going on. So we are making accommodations for that. The facility staff is working hard to do that.
Based on the facilities you have, is 200 enough then a day? Or would you say there should be more?
Well, whatever it takes. You know, it's easy math, really. So I went down the other day, and I saw there was 26 people doing it. And initially, somebody told me 26 people are producing 1,500 ballots a day. You do the quick math at 90,000 ballots, and you realize that we probably need 80 people a day working on this to get through the number of ballots in a timely fashion, at least 80. So we are prepared with 200. If we need 300, we will send 300. If we need 400, we will send 400. We will get the job done.
I'm April. I'm with Oregon Public Broadcasting.
How do you do?
I just wanted to ask to clarify, the county had offered help. When did they offer it? Was it when it was clear that there was a problem? Was this a week before, 2 weeks before the election day? Second question I had is, where are all of these employees coming from? Are they already county staff? Are they coming from a temp agency? Are they trained to do this kind of work?
First of all, we offered help the moment that we knew about the problem. And I believe maybe it was 2 weeks ago. I don't have a definite date for that. The county employees are people who are currently employed in one of these two buildings, and our other election officials have also offered up their people. They will be trained in how to do it. Our county employees work briskly and intelligently. They have work skills, they have life skills, which lends them to be able to do this work in a timely manner.
How is taking away from their normal day jobs impacting the county?
Well, it might have an impact. We'll just have to see. But this is number one priority right now, and we have to do it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Drew Reeves, KPTV. In the emergency meeting this morning, it was mentioned that in 6 hours, somebody got through 144 ballots. Mm-hmm. At that rate, this could take quite a while to get
these ballots. That was one team. And we had 26 teams. We can broaden that to 40 teams at two shifts. So if you can do the math, I can't do that math standing here, obviously. So if we had 80 people, which is 40 teams deployed at double shifts, you can do the math and figure that out. Now, that may not be enough. It's up to the county clerk to determine, to do the math and figure out if we need to have more teams or whatever we need to do. It really is a math problem, isn't it? I think we can all add and subtract and figure out what needs to be done. Yes, any other questions?
We have
Kimberly?
Yes. Okay, Chair Smith, we did have one from Grant Stringer at the Oregonian. Grant asks, will the county receive help from the Secretary of State or other Oregon counties to do this work?
Yes, Shamia Fagan, and I've been in conversation with her, has offered Sherry Hall help with everything that she needs. And Sherry Paul is an independently elected official. It is up to her to accept that help. We also could be bringing in election officials from two other counties who process ballots similarly to Clackamas County. And those counties are Yamhill and Marion County, who use barcodes on their ballots. And I believe that is available. It's up to the clerk to make that decision.
And she hasn't made that decision.
I don't know if she has made that decision or not. Yeah. Yeah, Kimberly, any more questions?
Those are all the questions that we have today.
Sir.
It seems that there's still not a concrete timeline, though. I mean, you know, we have an end date of June 13th. Mm-hmm. But there's no actual timeline. Am I correct, or is there one?
That question was asked by one of my commissioners in this morning's meeting, as you could see. And I cannot give an accurate timeline when these ballots will be counted. I think we need to have full employment of the staff available to see how fast that they can go through the ballots. And I think that determination can be made by our county clerk in a couple of days. And that would be up to her to determine, based on past performance, what the future deadline looks. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Can I ask one more then?
Sure.
I mean, I know the county clerk's an autonomous, she's got to have her autonomy, but seeing what's happening here, is there anything you see the county commission can do in the future to keep this from happening again?
Well, I think we have to let the clerk analyze what the mistakes are and what improvement she can take in improving the processes that she currently uses. And we can encourage her to do that. We can help her implement new processes. We can provide funding to make sure those processes are in place and this doesn't happen again. This was a big mistake. It was a huge mistake. And it's not one that I'm happy with at all. But this is the hand we're dealt. We have to fix it and we have to move forward. Yes.
Last question. How did the new law, the new post-stamp law, impact this? How does it impact the timeline? It sounded like you guys discussed it in the meeting, and I was it kind of was over my head.
Well, I'm grateful for the new timeline because it's allowing us more time. The only assurance that I can give to anybody is that we have a deadline by June 13th for certification of the ballots. And it's allowing for more ballots to come in. For instance, how many trays were picked up today, Kimberly? 31 trays were picked up today. Today. And that was an allowance in the new law. So people who wait or don't understand what's going on, those ballots were able to come in and their votes will be honored.
Chair Smith, we have one more question from Anthony Ettinger at the Willamette Week. He would just like to clarify that it's 90,000 ballots that are affected.
Well, possibly 90,000 ballots. I am not sure what the turnout is. At 307,000 ballots that were mailed, 30% is around 90,000. And that is the election ballots. And then there's a second ballot that was mailed, the PCP ballots, the precinct committee people ballot, that is set aside. And so there's a possibility that double that amount if people sent them in. So there could be much more, but we're concentrating right now on the people who stood for election in the individual offices.
Do you feel like there needs to be an audit or something more of like an outside investigation done into what happened that's caused this, as you said, huge mistake to happen?
The clerk has said what she thinks has happened, and we had a business meeting last Thursday, and she cited several areas where she felt that mistakes were made. She used a printer in Bend that she's been using for 10 years, and the barcodes came back blurred. And there's a certain type of paper, from what I understand, that you use, either long grain or short grain, and maybe the correct paper wasn't used or the toner wasn't matched. So it's really complicated. It's really up to the clerk. Ironically, our internal auditor did audit our elections division just this last year, and those results have been made public. And there were areas of opportunity for improvement cited by our internal auditor. And we have been in discussions with Sherry Hall on that. There were four major areas of improvement. She abided by two of them, and two of them are still sitting on the table. Yes.
And has Clerk Hall explained to you at all why she denied help from the county or the Secretary of State's office?
I don't know that she denied it. She hasn't totally accepted it yet. I don't know why.
But originally when she was offered the help, why did she decline?
I don't know.
But you said you offered her the help.
I did. She says, okay, I'll think about it.
And you didn't press it saying you're going to need it?
I did press it. And I'm doing whatever I can, and my board is doing whatever I can. It is on Sherry Hall. She's the one that runs the elections division. My board of county commissioners and our staff does not. We're just ensuring that we have adequate resources available to make sure that the ballots are counted in a timely and accurate and secure manner.
Frankie! How many times do I have to ask you for those audio files? I need them for the next episode.
I know. Man, I told you I'm trying to upload them now, but it's taking forever.
That's super weird. I thought your new internet provider was like super fast speeds.
Well, I thought so too. I mean, sometimes it goes really fast, but then I get heavy lag and glitches when I'm trying to make FaceTime calls or play games. It has cost me quite a few missions on Call of Duty Warzone, I can tell you. Even the videos on my doorbell cam come in jittery sometimes.
Well, Frankie, other than being very bad at video games, sounds like it's trouble with your upload speeds. Most internet providers only talk about their download speeds, since those are usually way faster.
Okay, hang on a second. You're telling me there are two types of internet speeds?
Yup. And upload speed is just as important as download. Think about how much stuff we send up to the internet, like the video of you that your friends see on the FaceTime call, or the response to your commands when you're playing action video games.
You're right. It sounds like I have slow upload speeds. Wish I would have known that when I signed up for internet.
Unfortunately, a lot of providers only tout their download speeds when talking about their services. That's what sets DirectLink apart. Not only do they openly advertise them, but their upload speeds are up to 10 times faster than other providers in the area. They know how important it is to have clear video when on that Zoom interview you have for your dream job, or when you're trying to catch those porch pirates that are stealing all of your Amazon packages and the Christmas things that you got for your, you know what? It's not a big deal. Give DirectLink a call to get started at 503-266-8111 or visit directlink.coop/internet.
I got a grudge against those.
I'm still waiting for my teddy bear to show up.
Hey, I'm AJ. I'm your local Oddmos franchise owner.
I'm Mike, co-founder of Oddmos.
And we're the hosts of The Odd Pod, a podcast about
life in the pizza industry. We're going to have on some franchisees. We're going to have some different vendors on. We're going to get a snapshot of what goes on behind the scenes in the pizza world.
Don't forget to tell them about the sports.
They're sports.
And the crazy wacky pizza that we have every Wednesday that we create. And we also have a special guest every week as well.
And I'm Gage, Odd Pod senior sports analyst.
Gage, who gave you that title?
Me.
Oh boy. Find us on Spotify and Apple Music and the Podbean.
Can Be Then is brought to you by Retro Revival. They are not your average antique shop, open daily. Find them on the corner of Northwest 3rd and Grant in downtown Canby, or connect with them on Facebook or through email at retrorevivaloc@gmail.com. We begin the fourth and final part of our look at Canby's fire history on September 16th, 1960. Firefighters responded to an early morning fire that day at Dr. A.G. McDonald's dental office at 121 North Grand Street in downtown Canby. Dr. McDonald lived in an apartment above the clinic, and that's where the fire actually began. The blaze spread quickly, destroying his bed, furniture, most of his personal effects, and all of his clothing. Fortunately, the dentist lived in a time where there was such a thing as bedclothes, and he was wearing them. Also fortunate, none of his dental equipment was damaged by the fire. So for some of our older listeners, if you were wondering why your dentist showed up for your appointment wearing his pajamas that one time, hopefully this will explain things. One morning, there was a loud boom that was heard all over Canby. I know what you're thinking. Hey, yeah, I heard that too. But no, this was back on September 3rd, 1982, and this actually happened. It happened at about 9:45 in the morning, and it was caused by a lightning strike, which exploded a large fir tree, that was the boom, and also killed an extremely valuable broodmare. The horse, Wild Clarion, was owned by Elwood and Alice Faced and was valued at about $20,000. The horse survived the initial strike, although Mike Harms, the veterinarian who examined her, said she had a singed streak of hair where the lightning had entered her, as well as several exit wounds. "I don't see how she's still alive," Harms told the Canby Herald at the time. Sadly, the horse was suffering internal bleeding from the incident and eventually had to be put to sleep. One of the last daughters of the 1967 Kentucky Derby winner, Proud Clarion, Wild Clarion had enjoyed some success racing at Portland Meadows before a scandal apparently prompted her retirement to Canby. In 1980, she'd had to forfeit a $1,600 purse she'd won after urine analysis showed a medication prohibited in two-year-olds. Her trainer, Ron Medeiros, had also been ordered to pay a $200 fine. Crazily, another lightning bolt exploded another fir tree on North Holly Street later that same day, raining smoking debris onto the home of Al Ehrenfeld. One large chunk of wood put a hole through Ehrenfeld's living room ceiling. "The strike knocked me goofy, like getting hit in the head with a baseball bat," he later said. The strike also caused a small power outage, blew out several of Ehrenfeld's windows and all of his electrical fuses, and rained debris onto his car. So maybe this explains the booms. Speaking of explosions, one caused by a natural gas leak ripped apart a Canby restaurant called the Gold Garden in the early morning hours of December 17th of 1984. The restaurant, located at 206 Southeast 1st, had just opened for business a few months earlier. It had previously been a restaurant called the Honey Bear, and before that was an A&W. The explosion tore off the rear section of the Gold Garden and littered the nearby railroad tracks with debris. The owner, V.N. Tran, estimated the damage at $90,000. The blast was reportedly heard as far away as Barlow, which is about 2 miles to the south. Brad Baker, a dispatching supervisor, said he had heard the explosion at his home about a mile and a half from the blast site. Anybody who was awake at that time would have heard it, Baker told the Oregonian. On November 7th, 1987, a fire broke out at a shed at Maple Street Park owned by Canby Kids, a youth sports club that was sponsored by the city at the time. Today it remains active in town as a nonprofit organization. Anyway, the shed was used to store sports uniforms and other equipment, and within minutes it was fully involved. It took a dozen firefighters to bring it under control, and though no one was harmed, it was estimated that over 200 football jerseys were lost in the blaze. Total damage in excess of $20,000 was reported. Arson, firefighters quickly determined, finding evidence of a liquid accelerant. They believed the suspect had used a wooden plank as a battering ram to gain access to the facility before setting it alight. A week later, a 17-year-old high school student was charged in juvenile court in connection with that fire. Detectives refused to release his name but said he would be charged with the equivalent of second-degree burglary and second-degree arson. Our final story will take us all the way to 2005. On June 16 of that year, 40 to 50 people were gathered for a meeting at Canby Alliance Church at 900 North Juniper Street when a fire broke out. The building was quickly evacuated, but Pastor Tim Barton and two other congregation members lingered in search of an unaccounted for teen. Barton went to the offices and called 911 before becoming trapped and disoriented in the thick black smoke. "It was dark," he recalled. "I could feel the heat and the pressure, so I dropped the phone, got to my knees, and tried to call out of there." He managed to find an exit door, but he didn't crawl out. He was blown out. The intense pressure from the blaze blew Barton an estimated 20 feet across the parking lot. Fortunately, he sustained only minor injuries, scratches, and bruises. According to the newspaper reports, the fire was started by a 16-year-old boy with developmental disabilities who was playing with a candle and some paper in the storeroom. The teen was not charged in the case due to lack of evidence. The fire caused an estimated $750,000 in damage. Canby Alliance Church was later rebuilt at the same location, bigger and better than before. Tim Barton is still the pastor. Several large beams were salvaged from the wreckage of the old church. They were fashioned into a cross that forms one of the decorative centerpieces of the new church's sanctuary today. That concludes our look at some of the most interesting and colorful moments from the history of the Canby Fire District. We have many more stories to tell you, but it will have to wait until next time on Canby There.
Tyler, did you know that the Australian lyrebird can mimic any sound that it hears? Even chainsaws?
No, that's super interesting.
Did you know that a baby puffin is called a puffling? Or no. That baby sea otters can't swim, so their moms wrap them up in pieces of kelp until they learn how to paddle?
Wait, do you know any trivia that isn't like animal related?
Not really, but here's some stuff you may not know about the Wild Hare Saloon, where Canby goes to eat and have fun.
Okay.
The Wild Hare is one of Canby's longest running locally owned restaurants. Owners Joan and Darren Moden have been in business for 16 years.
That's cool.
Yeah, heck, you were just a baby back then. And they love to give back. They've been members of the Canby Chamber for that long, and they donate over $20,000 to local sports, FFA programs, and civic organizations each year.
Wow, I'm legitimately, like, caught off. That's cool.
Yeah. They also support more than 30 jobs in the community through their award-winning staff, some of them as young as 18. Hey, that's older than you are.
Dude, I'm 10 months younger than you.
With the days getting longer and the weather getting warmer, the Canby Wild Hare's expansive outdoor patio is the place to be. Furry friends, welcome.
Well, that sounds great. I'm going to go check them out just off of Highway 99E next to the Space Age in Canby at 1656 Beaver Creek Road in Oregon City or on their website at thewildhairsaloon.net.
Now Hear This Canby is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. And of course, our show is edited by Cameron Clausen. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So a round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Canby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. To find more work from her, you can visit her website, olivia13.com.
Now Hear This Canby is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe. And we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.